Welcome back to issue 10 of Behind the Panels, the comic book podcast that dances with the devil in the pale moonlight. I'm one of your co-hosts, Richard Gray.
And I'm your other co-host, David McVeigh. How are you, Richard? We've hit 10. Two digits.
10 magnificent issues.
We've got double digits happening here.
Absolutely. I think that deserves this.
We both hit soundboards at the same time. This is going to get very messy. All right. So did you enjoy your week off, Richard?
I did. It was really good. It was a really relaxing time over Christmas, New Year. Got heaps of reading done. Got caught up with stuff from my other gig on therealbits.com and just generally am back on top. But I don't think that'll last very long.
No, because we started the new year and the previous screenings have already started coming in and everything's going to go crazy again soon. Now we're aiming for the February-March releases in cinemas, so that's going to take time.
Absolutely.
And we could be facing new comic books coming out soon. Well, it's a new story coming up from DC, so we'll wait and talk about that a little bit further on. So there could be a whole bunch of new reading to happen.
But then the break did give me a chance to reread this week's feature book, the wonderful Kingdom Come by Mark Waid and Alex Ross. So
Absolutely. Really,
I was really pleased to dip back into that again because I hadn't read that for a few years.
I actually read it about 6 months ago and I read it again now. So it's very fresh in my mind right now. It's a great book. So it's one of those books that's very interesting because when I first read it 6 months ago, I started reading it, I kind of went, oh dear. And I'll tell you why when we actually do the pick of the week. And then it actually got better. So, but we'll come back to that. What else have you been reading other than Kingdom Come?
Look, the other main thing I've been reading, you and I both saw Martin Scorsese's new film, Hugo, this week. Wonderful film, which prompted me to go back and read Brian Selznick's original book, but which was described as, some people call it a graphic novel, other people call it a picture book, other people call it a young adult novel. Some people call it, storyboards with novel-like qualities. He actually refers to it as a hybrid of all of those things.
That's a cop-out.
It's a cop-out. Look, it's more like a young adult picture style book than it is like a typical graphic novel. But there are long slabs, like sometimes 20, 30 pages at a time, where it's just images.
I've heard that it's I think the big misconception of this movie as well as the book is the fact that it's kind of perceived as a children's book. I think probably because it's a picture book, but it's not.
And that's where you find it in the bookstores.
Well, exactly, but it's really not, and it's not a children's movie either. So it's kind of an
odd... He writes young adult novels. Like, I mean, that's what he's known for.
Yeah. Oh, well, fair enough. So is it good, though?
It's marvelous. Like, the thing is, it's a huge, it's if you can find it, because some places it's gone out of print, but if you can find it, it's a 500-page book that you'll probably read it. You can proudly say you've read in a night or something, because as I said, it's mostly pictures. But in a way, you kind of don't want to do that, because the pictures are worth spending time on. They're black and white. On the surface, look very scratchy, but when you look at them, there's a lot, so much detail in each of these things, and so much beauty that Scorsese, really did manage to translate into his film, which has got a very different vibe to it, to the book, but both are definitely, really powerful little pieces in their own right.
I will have to borrow that from you and have a look at it, I think.
Absolutely.
I'm very curious. We'll talk more about the film, Hugo, on film, actually, when it resumes. It actually comes back next week. So,
yay.
And then we're back to the new year on that. What else have you been reading?
Oh, look, again, catching up on the New 52. I actually, before I read, I'll just say the New 52 stuff, because I do read, a dozen or titles. So, whenever they come out. So, I don't want to labor that point anymore, because every week I come back and talk
about
that.
Well, and that's the thing. What else have you been reading? Well, New 52.
Yeah. It does take up a lot of my time, because there are, 52 titles a month. But I did read, because a friend lent it to me, and I went back and started rereading Grant Morrison's run on New X-Men.
Okay, yep.
And that's, I don't know if you've ever read that one, that's with the Frank Quitely art. And this is the story that starts with... Magneto and his little island being blown up and everyone presumably dying, and the X-Men having to deal with just like all this entire...
Oh, this is when Geonisa or whatever it's called.
Yeah, just gets just gets Genosha, I think.
Genosha, that's the one.
Yeah. Just gets blown up, and you know them having to deal with that. It's just such a really that there's this, and there's a lot of mystery to the story, but it's also one of it's a really epic story as well. But it feels kind of intimate. It's an amazing run, and you know Grant Morrison just continues to impress me every time. I think, oh yeah, Grant Morrison, you're a great writer. I'll acknowledge that. But every time I pick up one of his books, I'm constantly amazed at just how good he is.
He is. I mean, he's very good at reinventing, which is kind of what he did with Animal Man as well, if you remember back when his run of Animal Man. He kind of reinvented everything that was going on during that time as well. It's interesting you bring up the Magneto's Island, because there's actually a miniseries you might want to read at some point called, it's actually Astonishing X-Men, called House of M. Which is well, we talked about it once on the show before. That's actually Brian Michael Bendis who wrote that series, and that's an interesting take on it as well, because it's also aftermath of that whole destruction of that island, which was the destruction of that island was a real turning point for the X-Men, because it was kind of what also woke up the world, because the Sentinels were kind of disbanded after that and all this sort of stuff. So it was a fairly big event. In mutant history, so to speak.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and it's just so well written, and I love Frank Quitely's art. It's really got this very distinct vibe to it. So, definitely want to check it out if you haven't read that. It's a few years old now, but it was just one that I was prompted to reread on the urging of a friend.
Okay, well, do you know what I read this week? I finally finished reading the 4-issue miniseries from Image Comics called 50 Girls 50. Which is a science fiction series, and it's awful. All right, so I read the first issue a while ago, and I've actually taken me a while to come back to it. And I finally said, I'm going to finish this goddamn thing if it kills me. And I finished it. It's by Doug Murray and Frank Cho, and art by Axel Medillion, I think his name is. And it really is like, in fact, the first two issues in particular are really like some sort of teenage wet dream. Because of course the spaceship is manned only by women, 50 of them in fact, and in skin tight, you know, spacesuits. So you kind of sit, they go down to a planet at one point, and the atmosphere of the planet starts eating away the spacesuit. So of course they end up naked by the time they're off the planet. And you sit there going, really, this is a story? This was actually recommended to me by somebody who said, yeah, it's a really interesting, fun book. And I just kind of look at it and go, this is really juvenile. In many ways, you know. So I wasn't.
I think that'd be Axel Medillion, by the way.
Medillion, is it? Okay.
Medillion. So I was just looked up the book.
I was very unimpressed. You can see by the front covers as well. If you see those on the article you're looking at, you can see the artwork is very.
It's funny. I normally like Doug Murray and Frank Cho. So
yeah, no, I just didn't think much of it. And it's also because it's only 4 issues. It feels really disjointed. It's whenever you have a 4-issue series like this, you kind of think it's going to have an overarching story arc. But the overarching story in this is never really come back to. And they kind of go on these little side things that they're dealing with, like, you know, a planet that's evolved where the dinosaurs are basically running the planet. And you sit there and go, really, this is it?
Might have to borrow that one off you just as morbid curiosity.
As morbid curiosity, absolutely. And also, like you, I've also been reading the 52, of course.
Up to issue fives now, aren't we?
Issue fives have just started to roll out the door, so... off we go again. Another month. I've got to say, I'm really liking the direction of Detective Comics.
Yeah.
And so I'm really liking that direction. And the other one that I'm actually really enjoying right now, because as of issue 5, I think it is, we've now, my volumes are turning down there. As of issue 5, we're actually now going into Superman's origin. Now, this is interesting, because this is why the 52 kind of happened anyway, because they had to reinvent his origin story.
Okay, I'll be keen to catch up on that one.
Yeah.
So the problem I'm finding is I am getting a majority of the new 52 at the moment, and I do have to drop a few of them, but I've been sort of stockpiling them a little bit and sort of reading, you know, 4 issues of Action Comics at a time. You know, obviously read the key ones when they came out. You know, I'll read like, you know, 4 issues of Action Comics at a time, and then and sort of get a sense of how each comic's holding together by its 4th issue almost immediately.
Yeah.
Because there were some comics that I just hadn't touched at all, and now I'm at this point where I can actually catch up and read the whole first 4 issues or 5 issues now at once. And there's some books that once you've read the first 5 issues, you think, no, I can definitely put this out. Other ones you think, if I just read the first issue and then had to wait a month for another one, I may not have actually bothered coming back a month later. I may not, my memory of that may have been poor, but having rolled on, and as you said, I think Detective Comics is a good example of this, that it is actually the direction of that has taken me somewhere where I'm quite enjoying. And I am actually getting the vibe of Justice League now, which I think when we last spoke, I said I wasn't quite getting it yet.
Yeah, you're kind of on the fence on that one.
I was on the fence, but again, it was the Aquaman issue. Actually, kind of.
Is that not awesome when Green Lantern says, "What can you do?"
Yeah.
I just thought that is awesome.
Yeah. So look, you know, I mean, it is. Look, I think this is the thing with comics, and look, you know, I think we're kind of unique in a way as comic book readers as a generation, well, at a time and place, because there was a time when it was a single issue thing and every issue was a cliffhanger and sometimes there'd be self-contained stories within one issue. Now everything is about the major arc, no matter what you're reading.
Mm.
And so you kind of have to stay with any comic, unless you really just hate the whole concept. You sort of have to stay with a comic for at least five issues to get a sense. So I think we're now at a point where by the end of the month we'll hit all the issue fives of the New 52. We can conclusively say these ones are working, these ones are not.
Yeah, look, and I even went and bit the bullet finally, so to speak, by going back and reading the books that I was most hard on. So I actually went and read all four issues of OMAC, and I read all four issues of Swamp Thing, and I read, you know, so I went and actually read those issues of the ones that I was most hard on, and I got to say that I think I'm still pretty hard on them. I think OMAC is a waste of time, quite frankly, and I think that if Swamp Thing doesn't do something soon, it's going to be a waste of time too.
Now, David.
Yes.
My spider senses are starting to tingle.
Oh.
Which means it's probably time for some comic news.
I think so. Oh, wait a minute. I've got something for that, don't I? Here we go.
What a scoop!
It is indeed. What do we got?
Well, first up, we're going to segue because we were just talking about the New 52. For the last 4 months, the traditionally strong Marvel has been on top. For the last 4 months, the traditionally strong Marvel has been dominated by DC's New 52,
mm-hmm.
Because it's a new shiny toy. But now Marvel has eked its way back to the top of the market share.
Not by much, though.
Not by much. And if you look at the figures, it is Marvel Comics has a share of 34.43%, a dollar share. And DC Comics has a 33.74 market share. So there's nothing in it.
They're really just scraping by each other, aren't they?
What I think, actually, an even more interesting part of the story is that Marvel owns a third of the market, DC owns a third of the market, and all of the independents now own a third of the market.
That is pretty impressive.
Yeah.
I was actually saying to you just before the show started, I am intrigued by, because I look at Boom Studios, and Boom Studios produces things like Irredeemable, Incorruptible. They're a good studio, right? And I look at Boom Studios, and I find that I'm intrigued by the fact that Dynamite has three times the market share that Boom does. And when you think of Dynamite, we're talking about things like the Vampira relaunch. Okay, granted, it's got the Kevin Smith comics. But Dynamite, I don't dive to Dynamite comics, whereas Boom, I'll go, okay, well, that's not such, you know, that could be interesting to have a look
at. I'm actually surprised Dark Horse is so low.
What, under IDW?
Yeah.
Yeah, considering IDW.
Actually, no, that makes sense. IDW's got some thingy, hasn't it?
It's got Star Trek.
Yeah, well, that's true.
Yeah, so IDW's got Star Trek and a couple others. Image Comics, I'm not surprised, is the king of the indies, because Image Comics has got Walking Dead.
Mm.
And a bunch of others, including Invincible, which has been going for 80?
And I got to say, almost 7% of the market is pretty amazing for an independent publisher.
Absolutely, absolutely. Yeah. So I think Image Comics is well deserved. I'm actually surprised that Dark Horse isn't above Image Comics, but I am glad to see Image so high. So what I can't get over is the fact that Archie Comics is still on the list.
I know, it's amazing, isn't it? And it's 0.82% of the market share, so a negligible amount of the market.
Yeah, it's tiny,
but it's hanging in there, just behind Viz.
Put it this way, Archie and Viz didn't fall into the other non-top 10. they are actually on the list, which is the most amazing thing. I thought the other thing that was also very interesting was the bottom list, and you can find this link. We'll put this link in the show notes because I think this is actually quite an interesting chart to have a look at. I think it's interesting to see the graphic novels are actually holding such a larger market share than just straight comic books. So it means people are buying trades more than they're buying individuals.
We should also point out, though, that of the top 10 comics sold in December 2011, eight of them were still DC.
Yeah, well, that's not surprising. It was all fresh and new and shiny at that point.
But these are all issue fours. So it's the only two Marvel that made it in there were Avengers X Sanction, number one,
right,
and Defenders, number one. So two number one issues made it in there. But then you go through this. Once you leave the top ten, though, it's fairly evenly paced, as you can imagine from the from the market shares being very similar. You have to get down a fair way, I think, before you even start seeing. Well, actually, I think the top 100, there's nothing. It's interesting. Lady Mechanica, number three, is at 95. It's from ASP. and I can't see in a cursory glance pretty much anything else from. Oh, hang on. Walking Dead, number 92. There you go. I think that was the highest rating indie.
Well, it also they wanted to go out and make a point that The Walking Dead was also the best-selling graphic novel of the month. Period.
Yes.
Over DC and Marvel, because Walking Dead number volume 15, which I have no idea what that equates to in actual issues, but their trade 15 was a huge seller. And that's what's putting Image on the map. I think Walking Dead is just carrying Image through at the moment.
Well, graphic novels are far more accessible for people who don't collect comics because they're available in bookshops. But which is interesting, though. This story leads into another story, which, David, you pulled up.
Yes. Hold on. Which one were we talking about
here? This is the which 52 titles might be on the bubble.
Yes. Well, they actually – it's funny because according to this article, they're not actually giving us the names of those titles yet. But DC has now basically conceded, saying that there are 10 – approximately 10 titles which are basically on the bubble, as they call it, which means that these are the ones that could be axed. And they're saying – there was talk and conjecture, according to this article, which was actually on Newsarama, that it would be on issue 5 where they would start doing this. DC has said that they will actually reassess at issue 8. So what they're saying, though, is that issue 8, we may have some mid-season replacements.
Yeah.
So there'll still be 52 titles, but if they cancel 10 of them, there'll be 10 new books.
I predict 10 new Batman books.
I'm just hoping Power Girl comes back into it somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
Look, cut Omak and put in Power Girl. All right, that would make me happy. All right.
Let me find out what's happened to Connor Hawk and Eddie Fires. That's all I want to know.
Fair enough. Fair enough. And can Green Arrow grow a beard already?
Yeah, damn straight. Well, I've heard that there's going to be a change in direction. My good friend Nima let me, as I think I mentioned, an article. Way back in issue 1 or 2, an article that was saying that yes, that he would be changing direction, eventually with a new writer. But we'll see what happens there. The next story that I threw in, moving swiftly along, I put this in. Basically, he's not in our audience today, but I put this in for your son Nikki.
I must point out that this is the first episode that we haven't had a studio audience.
I don't know if that's an indicator of the quality of the show that he's fled to Melbourne.
I guarantee he'll listen to it when he comes back. But yes, he will love this news.
This news is, and I took this straight from the source. This is from the from Lego.com. This is the official announcement in summer 2012 that Batman is back to save Gotham City in Lego Batman 2 DC Superheroes. Now, we spoke about this earlier on the show.
Yes.
Basically that the DC Superheroes will introduce, as the title indicates, other DC characters into the Lego world, into the Lego video game world, I should say, including Superman, Wonder Woman, and Green Lantern, who have to save Gotham City from destruction at the hands of nefarious villains like Lex Luthor and the Joker. So Yes, is all I can say.
Okay, now can I just say I love Lego Batman the game. I thought Lego Batman was terrific. But with the release of all of the new Lego Superheroes figures that are coming out this year, can somebody say cash in?
Yeah, and well, hopefully, and as we've said before, I'm really hoping they'll cash in on the Marvel superheroes as well. Because the thing that gets me giddy is the idea of running through a Marvel universe with a Lego Hulk smashing bricks left, right, and center.
A Lego Captain America. Come on.
And a Lego Captain awesome. America. I just really want to see. That's all I want.
Excellent. Yeah, look, the Lego Marvel figures are supposed to be coming out in mid-year. So we're doing the DC figures now. The sets have already started to roll out in the shops. So the game is coming out mid-year. So I can only think that if they are going to do another Lego superhero game, it's got to be end of the year.
Yeah.
That would be my guess. Looks like we're doing six-month blocks. So...
yeah, look, I mean, the Marvel, official Marvel Lego is really cool.
Yes. I don't think there's any geek in the world that would ever deny that.
Yeah. So, look, I mean, I'm looking at the site now. This is on, this is from when they were first announced, and they've got all the Marvel Lego and all the DC Lego lined up next to each other. They're both so cool. I don't care what side of the fence you sit on. They're all cool.
And come on, can we just say that hairpiece that they've given the Superman figure is awesome with the
little. Kiss curl and everything.
It's terrific. I can't wait.
It's almost as good as the hairstyle that they've given the Wolverine figurine, which is great.
Yes, my son is biting at the bit for these sets.
I don't blame him. I'll be purchasing this.
There's one set that's got Superman and Wonder Woman in it, and he wants that set so bad.
Oh, yeah. I think I might have to pre-order some of these.
He's looking forward to it. So I think this is hot. This is hot, and I can't wait to the actual video again because, as I said, the Lego Batman game was actually really good.
I'm going to have to go back and give that another play, actually.
Yeah, that was actually a really good game. I finished that one to 100%, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, with the Lego games that I have played, and I haven't got all of them, they're one of those games you just feel compelled to do that.
Yeah, you do. You feel compelled to get every single thing in the game.
Yep.
Now, I've got another story here, which I thought would be interesting to have a look at, which was actually, once again, from Newsarama. It's actually been reported in a few places, though, which is, we've talked about this earlier on the show and on the film show as well, which is Kevin Smith's new produced television series is coming out, which is called Comic Book Men. And it's basically set, from what I can understand of the series, it's just basically like a roundtable discussion with a bunch of comic book geeks who just talk about comic books.
I saw the ad for this being spoofed on The Soup recently.
Well, I'll tell you what, why don't I actually play the real ad, which is very short. So here's the ad for the new Comic Book Men.
These guys take their comics seriously.
Santa Claus, Batman, and then Robin are the most recognized faces on the earth.
Maybe too seriously.
Robin? Jesus, nowhere on that list.
Comic Book Men, series premieres February 12th, right after The Walking Dead, only on AMC.
He does have a point that Robin would be more recognizable than Jesus. So that voice was Kevin Smith. I didn't actually realize he was in the show as well. I thought he was just actually producing it, but apparently he's also making appearances in it. So
if you're listening to the States, that starts on February the 12th on AMC, but I don't know when we're getting it out here in Australia. I'm hoping it'll turn up on cable here in Australia, particularly given that next month in Australia there's a new cable network that's being launched, new cable channel that's being launched that's playing a lot of the AMC stuff.
Oh, really? What channel is it, do you know?
It's going to be called FX, I think.
Okay.
Or something along those lines. Or maybe not, but don't quote me on that. Something along those lines. And they're going to start playing things like The Walking Dead and Hell on Wheels and stuff like that.
About time Walking Dead got an Australian release.
Yeah, I know. I mean, for those of you in the States, Australia has not actually officially had Walking Dead in any format, on television, on DVD or Blu-ray or anything, or digital at all, officially anywhere.
To not make too fine a point of it, it's actually quite disgusting that it hasn't made an appearance on TV in Australia yet, considering that we are almost finished season two on American television.
Yeah.
You know?
And then it's not exactly been an obscure little show either.
No, it's like the number one rated show on television. It's ridiculous.
Yeah.
I'm glad to hear that's finally coming. So look, I'm really keen to see this, just out of curiosity to see what they do with it. But what I thought was kind of interesting was that this article, it's interesting because it's already caused a bit of a riff. Because on this Newsarama.com article, it's written by a woman by the name of Jill Pantozzi, I think it is. And she basically basically writes a little bit of her feelings on what she saw in this little trailer. And she basically says that she auditioned for the show. And now that she's actually seeing the show, she's quite disappointed that it just seems to be a boys' club. And, you know, where are the women being represented and blah, blah, blah. And all I could think is the show is called Comic Book Men.
Yes.
It's kind of in the title.
Women can be comic book men too, Dave.
I guess. No, I look, I can see her point, but the article as written actually sounds like sour grapes.
Yeah.
It sounds like, oh, well, they didn't want me, so how dare they? The other thing that I thought was kind of intriguing about it was that ad says that it's on directly after The Walking Dead. Now, if anybody who follows television knows it, they tried a new thing this year, which was going to be a talk show after Walking Dead called The Talking Dead, where they talked about each episode, and that seems to have vanished. So this seems to be replacing that. So obviously that didn't work.
I'm guessing Kevin Smith has a slightly broader appeal.
Maybe, just a little bit, yeah. Also, but think about it. They could actually talk about The Walking Dead on Comic Book Men because it's a comic book.
Yes.
So they could roll two things into one. Anyway, so I'm curious to see it. I will be keeping my eyes open to see if I can actually grab myself some sort of preview of that because who knows when we'll ever get it. So,
David?
Yes?
You know what that sounds like?
Oh, what's it sound like?
It sounds like it's time for
movie news. Wow, you're fast on the button. I was about to push mine.
Yeah. I still can't get over what Cam said when he was back on our Walking Dead episode, that theme always makes me feel like doing a line of coke.
Oh, dear.
I've never done a line of coke, but I imagine it's that kind of cheesy 80s kind of nightclub sort of thing that I've gone for there.
I don't know if we should be talking about drugs.
Actually, no, we're G-rated, aren't we?
We are.
Go back and edit that bit out.
No, I'm going to leave all that in there. All right, so we got some movie news. Now, I had troubles bringing these links in. I sound like I'm from the Song of the South or something. I had troubles, Miss Laura.
But, don't mention Song of the South. Disney will deny you.
Fair enough. So you're going to lead this off for me, but I have read some of these articles, so I know a little bit about it, but there was follow-up that I didn't know about. So hit me with it, Richard.
Well, everybody who's been following the Akira production, this is the live-action version of Akira. We already have an Akira movie, of course, based on the epic Japanese manga, which we will look at some stage down the track.
We actually have plans for that. So we
do have plans for that, yeah. So look out for that. Now, basically this week, production got shut down again.
And there was much redraw. All I could think was, yes.
Look, it's been shut down so many times already. As the Hollywood Reporter, which is where I took the first article of this from, says that Warner Brothers is pushing the pause button on Akira, which I think is a nice way of saying, according to an insider, everybody is being sent home.
Well, apparently the thing that I read said that they were worried about A, budget, and B, casting again. And yep. because I don't blame them, because Brian Hengeland is a terrible choice.
Well, look, the history of this thing is that Colet-Serra, who's the Wam Connick-Serra, who is the current, or Colet-Serra, who's the current director.
Yeah, for this
had already had his budget halved from the version that Albert Hughes was apparently going to direct. So he was now working on a budget that was around the $90 million mark. Not a huge, huge Hollywood budget, but it's a large budget.
It's big enough.
It's big enough. Absolutely. I mean, this is. So don't forget. I mean, Akira is big, though.
With today's technology and everything else, there's no reason that film should cost that amount of money.
No. So what were they looking is apparently. I mean, it was set to film with Garrett Hedlund to star. There was Kristen Stewart, Ken Watanabe, and Helena Bonham Carter at various stages in the deals. And now the studio wants to get the budget down between 60 and 70 million, which sounds reasonable.
Yeah, $60-70 million I can buy. That's fine.
Yeah. So basically, that's where it's up to. But according to, I got the article from Spinoff Online, but I think they took their information from Variety. They were saying that it's not dead yet. They're apparently searching for a high-end writer to polish a script. it's already passed through more than half a dozen set of hands. Now, apparently, according to Variety, executives are eyeing who else but Jonathan Nolan, who wrote The Dark Knight and The Dark Knight. I was going to say The Dark Knight Rises there for a second.
he's also currently a showrunner and lead writer on a new TV series called Person of Interest, which is actually quite good.
Okay, I haven't checked it out yet. And the other one, and the other writer apparently they're looking at is Michael Green to take a pass, who did write Green Lantern. So I'm not entirely sure why they're looking at.
Yeah, he's really going to polish it up, isn't he?
Yeah.
considering that the major problem with Green Lantern is probably the script.
Yeah. So basically where we're at was we're a movie that's gone down from about $140 to $150 million budget to $90. They're looking at $60 to $70. So we're looking at half the original budget. I think that's a wise decision because I think that I don't know if Akira will play to a $150 million budget audience.
I actually feel at this point in time there is so much bad feeling towards Akira that I think Warner Brothers needs to shelve this. And if they don't, they can come back to it later, but I think they need to shelve this for a while because there's every time this thing comes up, you can almost feel the groan from around the world.
In the meantime, I suggest that you start reading Katsuhiro Otomo's original manga. And in preparation for when we cover, we're going to do, well, what we plan to do is go fairly in deep with this one. So we're working out how often we're going to tackle it, but we will.
I'm thinking monthly at this point.
We might do monthly. We might do a volume a month because there's a good set of volumes there to get through. But we're definitely going to get a guest in on that one.
Yeah, we're going to get a guest in. I think what we'll do is we'll do the issues because I think there's 6 or 7 issues. I think we'll do it once a month for the period of those. Because they're so big, we can't combine them. And then I think what we might do is we might do something like, I don't know, I'm just talking off the top of my head, we haven't discussed this enough, but I'm thinking maybe we might do something like an audio commentary or a discussion on the actual animation.
That could be really good. Yeah, I think we should do that as well. Because I don't think anyone's done that. So that could be what, for those of you who are already listening to us, you know how good we are. But this could be what tips us over into the mainstream.
Absolutely. So I think we'll do the Akira season. We won't do it every week, of course, because we've got other books we have to cover. I just want to give it its just desserts. And it's also a book that I really want to read. So,
yes.
And I think that's what the mandate of the show was to catch up and discover. And I think it's a perfect opportunity for us to really delve into what is a landmark series.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And it's incalculable how much it's actually influenced over the years, and not just Japanese animation and manga, but visually and stylistically influenced so many Hollywood films and American comics over the years as well.
So stay tuned. So stay tuned for that because we're working that one out.
Okay. I think that's it for film news for the week, which means there's only time left for one more thing.
And I've got that here if you want it.
Well, see how you like this. What is it, Batman?
Whatever it is, it's awfully funny.
It's the pick of the week.
Yes.
All right. So our pick of the week... Yay! Okay, so our pick of the week this week is Kingdom Come by Mark Waid and Alex Ross. Now, this was originally put out as 4 books, is that correct?
That's right.
Yeah, it was originally put out as 4 books, big books. These aren't your standard comic book size books. And then it was eventually compiled into 1 graphic novel for its trade release. Now, how did you consume this?
I've only ever read this as a graphic novel.
Okay.
And I have the graphic novel in my hands right now. I actually went back at the first. The reason I bought it originally is because I really loved Alex Ross's art, and which is magnificent. And you will have seen Alex Ross's art on whenever there's like a DC annual or anything that they do. They always get his big art splashed across the cover because he does these beautifully painted versions of all the characters, and what's impressive about this book is that the whole thing is painted.
It's beautifully done. I actually thought some of the characterizations of some of the heroes was really interesting. Like he actually drew Wonder Woman as really quite harsh.
Yeah, and really butch.
and really butch. And I love the and this is kind of jumping ahead a little bit, but his rendition of Captain Marvel. much later in the book, he looks like a grown-up version of Bob's Big Boy.
He really does. He does.
Because if you ever see Bob's Big Boy statue outside the restaurants, that little pudgy little hamburger guy, the way he's drawn him as Marvel as an adult with the smile and everything, he looks just like what I would imagine Bob's Big Boy growing up.
I think that's quite intentional, actually.
I think it might be.
He's if you ever do get the hardcover, actually, there's a, or sorry, not the hardcover, the graphic novel, there is a section at the back called Apocrypha, and it's got Alex Ross explaining how he came about the design concepts for each of those characters and who he based them on. And if you get lost in this book, which you might if you're not that familiar with the DC universe, he's got three pages of labeled character drawings and some of the scripts from Mark Waid and all sorts of things. So it's definitely worth getting in that form if you've not read it in that. And it really, I think it really does need to be read in that form. But that's my opinion. But you, did you consume it that way, David?
No, I actually consumed it as the four individual issues.
Okay.
So it's interesting because I didn't get any of the surplus material, basically. I just got the books as they were. And you take it as you go. And so I've got each book with its little subtitle and everything else that it comes with it. So like the first book, for instance, is actually called Strange Visitor and so forth. It's really hard to summarize this into a small summary. But if we were to actually summarize this, we could basically say it's set in a future time. I think they're saying it's about 10 years past the prime of the superheroes. So we're never really given a hard time. But we're kind of figuring that superheroes, the main superheroes that we know, Superman, Batman, etc., have been gone for about 10 years. And basically, the new breed of superheroes are an angry lot, to say the least. Mm. And they have gotten to a point now where there are no more supervillains. They just fight each other. And they just have complete reckless abandon for everything going on. Now, what we have in this book is we have an elderly No, he's not a priest. He's a pastor, isn't he? He's a pastor.
Yes.
Who is basically having visions because of one of his friends who has died early on in the piece. He's having visions which bring the Spectre, who's always been a character that's always confused the hell out of me in the DC universe. But the Spectre comes forth and basically takes him on a journey to show him what's going on, because apparently an Armageddon is coming. And the Spectre needs his visions to guide them through this mess of a universe that's happened at this point in time. What's happening in this universe is basically it's drawing the older superheroes out of retirement to help clean up the mess. But these are an older, more bitter, I don't know, how would you describe the older breed of heroes, the Flashes and the Supermans? They're all...
They're cynical and tired.
That's it. They're cynical and tired. That's a perfect way of doing it. And so basically they're not... The laughing and happy superheroes that they were 10 years ago, now they mean business. And
it's interesting because I think this is part of DC's Elseworlds line, which they describe rather nicely as, in Elseworlds, heroes are taken from their usual setting and put into strange times and places, some that have existed or might have existed, and others that can't, couldn't, or shouldn't exist. And the thing I like about this, they seem to have taken the logical line through from an older version of the DC comics. It's kind of almost going back from the golden era and stretching that through to its futuristic conclusions, rather than taking our modern version of Superman. Well,
yeah, it does, because if you think, even just in the design work, like the Flash actually has the helmet and stuff like that.
There's an interesting note about Flash with a helmet, because I wondered that as well.
Because that's actually the Earth 2 Flash.
Well, one of the things they note in the back of this book about the design of the Flash is that it says that the Flash is emanating from the Speed Force. The future Flash may hold all the spirits of the previous incarnations.
Oh, okay.
So that's why. But you always see the helmet. That's why I always thought he was the original.
That's right.
Flash there as well.
So you're kind of having all the Flashes blending into one.
Yes.
Yeah, very interesting idea. And like, there's a great line in this book where Superman goes to see Bruce Wayne. And he's talking about, will Bruce rejoin him to, you know, clean up the world as it is now? And Bruce actually talked, and they're talking about being dark. And he's saying, you've always been dark, Bruce, but I didn't know how dark you've been, basically. Yeah. And I love the fact that he turns around and goes, you're one to talk. Black's an interesting color. Because Superman's S now, of course, is black rather than the traditional yellow. he goes, interesting color for you. You know? And I love that line, because it's like, yeah, even Superman's Even his costume has darkened. You know, everything about him is darker. And Wonder Woman goes into some very interesting territory because of her background. We'll talk about that as we go down the issues. But look, I think it's a really interesting book. You're right. This universe that DC has, this side universe, has spawned some very interesting books in the past. Another one was Superman Red Sun, where they proposed the idea that what if Superman actually landed in Russia instead of America? And how would that have influenced him? And it's really great when you can get out of the when you can go into your own sandbox and basically experiment.
And the one thing I'll just point out during the one of the other last big DC crisis type things, which is what they did it was a run called 52, and they did all these things where they were splitting up, and there's all these different multiverses because there were 52 Earths, and one of them was the Kingdom Come Earth. So that was in there, but another one was. That was Earth 22, it was designated, and the Red Sun Earth was one of the Earths as well. But then during, and I'll talk about this a bit more after we've looked at the book, during the main run, Justice Society of America, around that time, they actually managed to incorporate, in a storyline called Thy Kingdom Come, they were actually bringing connections between the modern-day DCU and what would eventually become Kingdom Come.
Interesting.
Introducing a character called Gog, and how he was connected to potentially a future character called Magog,
right,
who is one of the major characters in Kingdom Come. But that's kind of a little bit further down the track. We're jumping ahead. Let's get into issue one then.
Okay, so the first thing I was going to say is at the beginning of the show, I alluded to the fact that I actually kind of went, uh-oh, when I started to read this. And I was actually a little worried, was because it opens with a lot of scripture. It opens with and I kind of went, oh, where are they going with this? Because this is like fire and brimstone type preaching. But it actually all makes sense. And I think it actually, they bring it into line very, very quickly by basically talking about this impending Armageddon, which is basically because, let's face it, superheroes are like gods, and the power that they wield on Earth. And so they're basically bringing it all in line to what the scriptures wrote. And that's where we start in this hospital bed with this dying man who's having visions, and he's equating it all to the scriptures.
The dying man, as it turns out, is actually the original Sandman.
Yes.
That was his whole thing. He had visions, but the pastor that's there, and the pastor's name is Norman McKay, and he's more or less our guide through this whole world.
Hmm.
And everything that happens is observed through him. Is there reading scripture to him by his bedside before he leaves. And amidst a crumbling and decaying and superhero fighty world, he starts too having these visions.
Yeah. So what we basically have is we have the dying man has now passed his visions on to McKay. Now, what I think is interesting here is the introduction of the Spectre. So we see the world. We see the world as a mess, and then the Spectre comes and visits him. Now, because I'm late to the DCU. The Spectre has always confused me. So can you fill us in a little bit about what the Spectre's role in the DCU is?
The Spectre is confusing because he's appeared a bunch of different times in different comic books, and it's always been a little bit different. And the original Golden Age version was, and I think this is where they've taken this one from, he was a hard-boiled cop, named Jim Corrigan, and that's alluded to at the end of this book as well. He was murdered, and I think in the original one, according to the entry here I'm reading, he was stuffed into a barrel, which was then filled with cement and thus drowned, and his spirit was refused entry into the afterlife.
Right.
And then eventually he became the spirit. More recently, he's undergone different incarnations. They've always basically been this. He's been the spirit of vengeance, and he has to anchor himself to a human being. The modern age version of him was again similar kind of background, but some people might remember that for the longest time, Hal Jordan was also the spirit.
Well, he was fused with him.
He was fused with him,
yeah.
And that was following his own death after the result of a big crisis involving him and Parallax and all sorts of things there. That also it was Hal Jordan was still the Spectre when he resurrected the person who killed him. Oh, no, he didn't resurrect, but he was instrumental in the resurrection of Green Arrow when they brought him back to the DCU as well. So that's kind of worth it. But he seems to have fallen in and out. He was involved in Blackest Day and Brightest Night as well. There was a big thing called Day of Vengeance, which was running through. It was one of the lead-ins to the big Infinite Crisis that they had a few years ago. So he's been kind of on and off an instrumental figure in a lot of different major storylines in the DCU over the last
quarter century, I guess. Because he's kind of on this ethereal plane and he can kind of phase in and out, he makes a perfect storyteller.
But you also get this the sense that he's incredibly powerful, but there are limits to those powers. Mm. And one of them is that he has to be anchored to a human host. And it's kind of almost, it's funny, because with the last issue we did, Batman Noel, and that was all about the ghosts of Christmas past, present, and future. Mm. And this one kind of has, in some ways, that sort of ghost of Christmas past, present, and future as well, because the Spectre effectively shows Norman McKay what, you know, reminds him of the glory days, shows him what the world has become and what the potential future is if, you know, things aren't taken care of. But he's not, he doesn't have to personally change. It's, he has to change. He has to, you know, remind the heroes in a way.
I love the fact that the Spectre keeps saying to him all the way through, from issue one all the way through, a time will come where you're going to have to make a choice.
Yeah.
And McKay's like, why do I have to make the choice? You know, who am I, you know? And the Spectre said,
in some ways, I wonder if this is kind of like a message to readers. It's kind of like, you know, when Kingdom Come first came out, and it was originally published back in 96. Mm. And as we know, the mid-90s, there was a lot of different changes for comics. They were trying to get them darker or trying to make them more edgy or what have you. And I wonder if this was kind of like, I wonder if it was sort of like, you know, a message to readers saying, like, you guys will also have to make a choice at some stage. Mm. Do you want a future full of superheroes that bring truth and justice and optimism to the world, or do we want darker and edgier heroes with a multitude of new costumes every week? You know,
I think so. And I think it was DC basically saying, you know, let's back off a little bit, you know,
because it really is, even though it represents a darker future, it really is a tribute to all things glorious about the DC Golden Age.
Mm.
Which is what I love about the book. And as you get through to the end of issue one, and I'm from my thing here, I'm trying to work out exactly where that ends.
Issue one ends with, I can tell you, hold on, issue one.
Oh, hang on, sorry, no, I know exactly where it ends here. I found chapter two. Issue one ends with the return of Superman.
Yeah.
And it actually has, look, up in the sky, and Superman descends holding... thing, and then Norman McKay has a vision of that the apocalypse is still possibly going to come, or Armageddon is still hasn't ended; it's just begun. Mm. But there is this sort of sense of hope that what the world needs is a Superman.
Absolutely. It needed what the world needs at this point is it needs those costumed heroes to actually invoke a sense of hope rather than dread. Because every time you see the costume heroes in this future, basically they're fighting with each other. There's going to be civilian casualties. They don't care. And
it's become their own. The world has become their playground rather than they don't. There's no with great power comes great responsibility for these people.
Whereas Superman represents that. And when Superman retired, when he walked away from it, that sense of hope and that sense of responsibility actually left all of the other heroes as well, who all basically took their lead from Superman. And all walked away as well, because they said, without you, we can't do it, you know?
And as we move into issue two, which starts with another bit of scripture, as does every issue, there's a character called the American Mando. And his Minutemen, who in his own description, he said, "This is my country, and for years, the American Mando and his Minutemen have protected the U.S. from foreign threats. Yada yada yada. The poor, the tired, huddled masses camping on our shores, begging citizenship. You know, as you immigrants dare expect sanctuary, well, no more." You know, and he sort of goes on to say, "Today, the American Mando declares war on the wretched refuse." shortly afterwards, we get this beautiful page in which Superman, Green Lantern, The Flash, Power Girl, Hawkman, Wonder Woman, and the Ray, I think, descend from the heavens as very godlike.
No, they're like angels. They're like the archangels coming in.
You know, shrouded by these backlit clouds.
Yeah.
And it's such a beautiful classic bit of imagery, the kind that Alex Ross draws so well.
Yeah.
And there's an introduction not long afterwards of the future Robin, which I think is quite interesting.
Yes. I like the fact that
the only thing that paints it as an Elseworlds book, because as we know, Robin would have been, unless it's a different version of Robin. No, it's meant to be Dick Grayson. No,
it's meant to be Dick Grayson, but I like the fact that it's kind of his new costume is kind of like this hybrid of Batman, Red Robin, Robin. It's like it's all over the place.
Yeah, it's such a wonderful, you know, moment. And then he comes down and then Superman flies down to Earth and they give a press conference.
Yes.
which is basically an ultimatum to the other heroes, saying that, you know, first of all, they, you know, kind of apologize. Sorry, good afternoon. Many of us may remember us. Been away for a while. That was a mistake. And then he sort of goes on to say, look, you know, this is the problem as we see it. You know, metahumans are acting without principles and they should honor our principles. And then we get the sense also, and he said, I don't appreciate anyone acting without our sanction. Now, This is a turning point for the book because two things happen here. One of the reporters mentioned anyone, would that include Magog? Superman, you're truly prepared to confront Magog in light of what has gone before. And Superman just looks down and remains silent. So one, we get a sense of something has gone on in the past with someone named Magog.
Which is what put him into retirement.
Which is what put him into retirement. We don't know what yet. And then second of all, there's this sense now that even though the heroes of old have returned, they've changed.
Yeah.
And it's kind of, they're still kind of saying, we're back, we're here for truth and justice, but it's either truth or justice and you will obey. Which was sort of foreshadowed in the first, back in the first issue, when the Spectre just says of Batman, Batman has his city under control.
Yeah.
And it's just basically martial law run by
these robotic
Batman creatures.
Yeah. I love that there's also, after the press conference, I love there's that line from the UN where the guy goes, ladies and gentlemen of the delegation, is anyone here delighted with what they just heard? And he goes, no, why am I not surprised?
Yeah.
Because it's like, yeah, so basically Superman and crew are now here basically enforcing their own law.
Mm.
Which they see as right, but that's not really what they were there for.
No, and I think the Spectre describes it as, you know, normal cases there's fear in the room, and the Spectre says, no, it's a validation of fear, that mortals are no longer the captains of their own destiny, which is such a powerful thing, and it's something we're reminded of constantly throughout this struggle between human choice and these godlike creatures, which is very much, to sort of go back to your original thing, a religious debate as well. The idea of, you know, if God's in charge, then do humans really have free will and all that kind of thing as well. So this is the very extreme version within the DC universe. Now, issue two is also great because it introduces the aged Bruce Wayne Batman.
Actually, introduces a few aged heroes here, which I love because one of them is yours.
Yes, absolutely. He's introduced in the same sequence.
Yeah.
And I really love the Batcave because it's sort of half underwater. And the pennies is kind of, the giant pennies still there floating, kind of floating, but sort of half submerged in the water. The dinosaurs all still there. And Bruce Wayne is in this big contraption that's a neck brace, arm contraction thing. Clearly, his body's been broken in about 50 million different places. And he's this sort of got this massive deck of computers, so he's still fighting the good fight, but remotely.
Yeah, so he's got it all. He's got Gotham basically controlled by remote control at this point because he's no longer going out in a suit to do this because he's literally, it's not just neck and arms, he's braced from head to toe.
Oh, yeah. and he actually references it, and I can't remember if it's in this issue or not, where he says, you know, so once my identity got exposed, Bane and Two-Face happened to it. Doesn't matter. I have everything I need down here.
It's because you're saying Wayne Manor's been destroyed.
Destroyed, yeah. So, you know, and this at this point, because Superman's on his recruitment drive at this point, trying to get people to rejoin the fight for truth and justice. And he meets a you know, unsurprisingly very cynical Bruce Wayne, who's saying, well, look, you know, we've been still been fighting it for years, Clark, where have you been? And what's interesting all throughout this is that he keeps whenever anyone calls Superman Clark, he says, don't call me that.
He says, don't call me Clark. That's right.
Don't call me Clark. He wants to be called Cal. And this is sort of an early indication that everyone's died that he's ever cared about. Ma and Pa Kent have died. It's inferred that Lois Lane has died. Well, he says his wife has died, which we can assume is Lois Lane, because later on it's explicitly said somebody from the Daily Planet was killed, and he was very upset by that. By the Joker, which we'll get to eventually. it's a thing that the Superman has given up his humanity almost at this point. So, and he's sort of cut ties with everything human. Now, in the same scene that we introduce Batman, after Superman leaves, it's revealed that hiding in the shadows were three other humans, and Oliver Queen,
the Dinah Urban Warriors.
Lance. Yeah, the old human warriors, Oliver Queen, Dinah Lance, and Ted Kord, which they don't actually say there, but we better know as Green Lantern, Black Canary, and the Blue Beetle.
Yeah. Well, I actually refer to him once as Beetle.
As Beetle.
He actually says, but there's one line where Oliver Queen, I think, actually says, that's just like you, Beetle, or something like that.
Yeah.
So it's the only time you actually get a sense of who they were.
And it's interesting because they don't really refer to themselves as Black Canary and Green Arrow throughout the rest of it, because it's kind of like those days are gone. We're not doing that anymore, but we're still fighting the good fight.
Yeah,
as we are, as ourselves. And as the issue goes on, you know, he recruits more people, and as the narration describes it, whenever possible, Superman negotiates peace. Whenever impossible, he enforces it, and at every turn, transforming enemies into allies.
And I love the fact that they fly as a pack.
Yes.
Everywhere Superman goes, he's surrounded by that core contingent. He's posse. He's got Power Girl, he's got Wonder Woman, he's got Hawkman behind him. There's this posse that always flies together, you know? And they're beautifully drawn, how they show them flying over city sides and people are all pointing up to them. It's like this is like they're the saviors, basically.
Absolutely. And look, of course, it's not just the saviors that are reintroduced in this issue. It's the villains as well.
One of my favorite scenes, actually, in the entire comic book.
I think I know which one it is.
Is the introduction of Lex and his table of people. and I love, in particular, I love Edward Nygma.
Yeah, he's great. He's just this kind of crazy old man.
Because, of course, this is the Riddler as we know him. And I love the fact that everybody who's being introduced into the room, he's asking the question like it's a game show.
Yeah. So it's like
here's Selina Kyle. He goes, who is Catwoman?
Who's Catwoman? And her companion, Edward Nygma, who was the Riddler.
So you kind of get this sense that maybe he's a little bit, he's gone a little bit over the deep end.
He might,
because Selina seems to be looking after him. Because he's there as a guest to her.
He's solely reminded that he's here solely as a grace to Miss Kyle.
Yeah, exactly. And there's actually a moment of clarity from him, though, as the plan starts to unravel. Because what we see here now is that Lex, an elderly Lex, has basically set up this group of people who are basically fighting for human rights, or so they say. And so it's him, and it's the descendant of Ra's al Ghul, and it's Selina Kyle, and so forth. And they're all basically putting into plans in motion to try and regain control of the planet, to take it away from the metahumans.
And I absolutely love the way that Lex Luthor's been drawn.
Yes.
And it is kind of portly, cigar-chomping, almost 1980s style businessman.
There's actually there's actually a vague sense of Kingpin in him.
Yes, it looks like the Kingpin in this. But and I love that scene where someone says to him, "What? Nothing to fear from the Leave? Not even Superman?" And he basically chokes, spits out, "He will not touch me. He will not." He can't get the rest of the sentence at all.
And I love that this is also
got a marvelous anti-Superman plan. Isn't that right, boy? And then, as we've referred to earlier, his right hand man just comes up and says, "Absolutely, Mr. Luthor." And he's just really looks like, as you said, big boy.
Yeah, he looks like Bob's big boy. What can I tell you?
And he's great. Who we later find out is actually Captain Marvel, who has managed to be brought in under control.
Actually, what's actually creepier is that the smiling man who's actually going, yes, absolutely, Mr. Luthor, isn't even Captain Marvel. This is the grown-up Billy Batson.
Yeah.
And that's what the creepy part is, because he's kind of like, he's, because Billy Batson was always this young boy who was always about being right and all this, and that's what kind of was the core of Captain Marvel. And to see Billy Batson growing up is just wrong to start with, you know what I mean? Because it's, he's supposed to be a boy, you know? But then to see him growing up into essentially looking like what you would imagine Captain Marvel supposed to look like, you know what I mean? It's kind of odd. And he's got this unnerving smile that never leaves his face.
Yeah, no, it is creepy. And when he is finally revealed, well, when he finally does transform into Captain Marvel, there's a terrific scene there, and it's just all that those evil smiles just become very, very sinister.
Yes, yes. I also love the fact that there is actually a line. Is it in this scene or is it in one of the later ones? It might actually be in one of the later ones where they actually talk about kryptonite.
And yeah, I love that bit. No, you talk about it.
Yeah, and he actually said, and Luthor actually says, kryptonite doesn't pack the punch it used to because of all of the solar radiation that he's absorbed over the years, and so they've now realized that kryptonite's not going to help. It's just it's a minor inconvenience more than a dangerous thing, you know.
I'm going to skip over a little bit of the rest of the issue because there's three key people that Superman and his team meet in the rest of this issue.
Mm-hmm.
Before Lex Luthor has his own key meeting. One of them he meets is Aquaman.
Yep, yep.
Our new best friend.
Our new best friend, absolutely.
Who's now just retired to life as the ruler of the sea, the other 70% of the Earth, as he describes it.
Yeah. What does he say? He says, you've got all those heroes to look after the landmasses, but only I look after the rest of it.
You know? Exactly. And so he basically rebuffs Superman's suggestions, and at one point, and Diana actually suggests using the undersea as a prison for all.
This is actually the first time we get wind of this plan, which is the metahumans who don't come and play nice. Basically, Diana has a plan to imprison them, and Superman actually says at one point, he goes, "Were you ever going to tell me about this?" You know, and I think it's a pivotal moment because it starts to show Diana's true colors. Because we also find out in that Aquaman scene that she's been kicked out of Paradise Island.
Exactly right, and had her title removed, and it's also the start of the divide between the two of them, which is really interesting. The next character we finally get to meet, Magog.
Yes, who we finally find out what it was all about.
And it's interesting. The first line he's introduced with is "gently, gently." Which I think is interesting because it's sort of built up to make it sound as though he was this big arch villain, and he wasn't at all. And his first conversation with Superman makes it sound like he's a villain. But what actually happened was, in the wake of an incident where the Joker managed to kill a whole lot of – he killed 92 men, and as I think Superman says, and one woman.
Mm.
Which presumably
would
is
be Lois, yeah.
The world kind of rose up and said, look, maybe we don't want Superman's brand of justice anymore. Maybe we need someone a bit harder. And when Magog actually killed the Joker, rather than taking him to court, Superman actually took in Magog and had him tried for murder. But he was acquitted, and the world basically said at that point, no, we prefer him as a superhero to Superman. Superman's gone off into exile, and the world as we know it now, with all of the superheroes fighting amongst each other, basically resulted really, you can be traced back to almost that one point. But as Magog says, really, if you think it was just then, you're more naive than I thought. You know, really, the public was turning against your 1950s brand of justice long before I came along.
Well, they're saying the world didn't want the Boy Scout anymore. They wanted somebody who would take decisive action, or that's what they thought they wanted.
Again, coming back to that real world thing of maybe that's not what comic readers want anymore. You know, comic book readers maybe didn't want the 1950s Boy Scout Superman. They wanted someone darker. And let's not forget, around the mid-90s, which is the time they killed off Superman and brought him back as a slightly darker, long-haired character.
Yeah, and interesting to note that he actually has a ponytail in this flashback scene. When he's in the courtroom with Magog, Superman is shown from behind, and he actually has that middle-aged ponytail.
I am not surprised if this is a direct dialogue that Mark Waid is having with DC circa 1996.
Yeah,
which I should say was about the time I stopped reading comics for the first time. Which is not surprising, given that this the kind of chaotic world that we're seeing in here is a microcosm for the comics industry at the time.
And I have to say, this would have also been about the period of time when I stopped reading DC Comics, because I actually found the universe messy. I didn't understand what was going on. And I found Marvel, I took comfort in the fact that at least Marvel had a straightforward storyline.
Yes, now, exactly right.
What's really interesting at the moment is that I actually feel exactly the opposite at the moment.
No, I agree too, and I'm not reading Marvel, and I actually went through a period where I read a lot of Marvel books. I read a lot of Marvel books. I really got into Daredevil and Fantastic Four and about three different Spider-Man books and so forth. Now I'm not reading any.
I find at the moment DC is actually, even with the New 52 and the confusion that is lying with what's rebooted and what's not, I'm finding myself much more intrigued by that universe than I am with Marvel's universe at the moment, which just it feels messy at the moment. So I think it's interesting we've gone complete flip turn on everything that's going on. So now what I think is interesting about Magog at this point is that he is absolutely eaten up with guilt over all of this. I mean, that's the thing that really gets me is the fact that he's been built up over two issues now as this person who drove away Superman, basically. And when we finally meet him, he's actually kind of pathetic. And he kind of just falls down saying, if you're going to take me out, do it now. because basically he's in Kansas where a battle that he was involved in cost the lives of basically everybody in Kansas.
And what he says is they chose the man who would kill over the man who wouldn't, and now they're dead.
Mm.
So punish me, lock me away, kill me, just make the ghosts go away.
And it's a really powerful moment.
It is. And Superman just looks down and Diana reaches out to comfort him, and then he says, "We're at war," and she takes her hand off his shoulder.
Mm.
And it is a powerful moment, and we instantly go on the subject of war. They go to Apocalypse, which is I always love Apocalypse. I always love seeing it in the DC comics. And has it turned up in the New 52 at all?
Not yet, but no. we just introduced Darkseid in Justice League.
That's right. I remember that. Yeah. That's right. They have two. Of course they have.
Now, is it Darkseid or Darkseid?
It's Darkseid. The only reason I pronounce it Darkseid is because they did one of the animated DC comics that they do on DC Animation has been putting out the last couple of years, all of which are brilliant. I actually pronounced it as Darkseid in that, and that was the only time I've heard it said.
I think my entire life I've always called it Darkseid.
I have as well, but they pronounced it Darkseid, so I'm assuming that's the official canonical way of pronouncing it.
Fair enough.
So there you go. And then, anyway, that issue ends. I want to skip to the end of the issue because we've still got two issues to go.
Yeah, I think it's just important to note that what we do have at the end of this issue, very briefly, is basically they go from Apocalypse and so forth. They're looking for an answer to this jail situation.
Yeah, exactly right. Yeah. And the final meeting that takes place in this movie is Lex Luthor in this movie. In this issue, is Lex Luthor's little group is introduced to the newest allies against the gods, and it's Batman and his cohort of Ted Kord, Dinah Lance, and Olive Queen. And so it's fine. These two have come together. So Batman and Lex Luthor are ostensibly working together.
Which is just wrong in every way.
It's wrong in every way. And and which is probably why the next issue starts with, "And he cried with a loud voice when a lion roareth, and when he cried, seven thunders uttered their voices." which is a picture of Captain Marvel.
Yeah.
Yeah, so as you said, they were looking for a solution to the prison situation. And then we get to issue three. Now, David, I don't know about you, but at this point in the comic, you mentioned you had a few issues with the book.
Yeah.
By issue three, it's – I'm not going to say it's losing me, but I think narratively it falls down a little bit here.
Well, I kind of feel like they're stretched.
Yeah, I think it could have ended in a third issue, but yeah. they remind us about 14 more times that there has to be a choice between, you know.
That's exactly the point, is they stretched it out. And it could have been a three-issue arc, because a lot of what happens in issue three is repeating again and again and again what we've – it's basically repeating the message. It's like trying to drive the moral down your throat.
Mm.
Now, the one thing I will give issue three, though, is that wonderful visual image, which I think I have in the individual issues. It's actually on issue six on page six of the issue. I don't know what page it's on yours, which shows the prison built, that they finally built. And I love the fact that it actually looks like the Legion of Doom's headquarters.
Yes. They've got the same architect.
Yeah. As soon as I turned the page onto it, I went, I know that building.
Yeah. You know? It was a nice little Easter egg there.
Yeah. And of course, inside. And look, you know, as far as prisons go, this is a pretty nice prison. You look inside, it looks like Paradise Island. It's got columns and, you know, it's a beautiful looking thing inside. I don't know what they're all complaining about, you know, anyway.
But you also get the sense of growing in there, because it becomes the focus of the final issue, that it's a powder keg waiting to go off.
Well, they've put a lot of very powerful people into one place who don't all get along in the best of times. And then they've got this huge hologram of Superman basically telling them off constantly all day long. So yeah, it's not surprising that this thing was going to blow.
But two major things happen in that issue. One of them, it's a couple of major things. One of the things I really like this issue, I found it really interesting that it was the wizard, the Galactic Lords, and the immortals from Oa,
and the Guardians, the Guardians of the Universe.
Guardians of the Universe. They're all talking to each other, you know, saying, and the wizards basically saying, "Well, you know, we've got to help," and the Guardians like, "No more, no, we don't do that anymore.
No, we're done,
we're done." And I thought that was a really nice touch, because yes, that is a really important thing. They introduced Deadman briefly, and he's such a wonderful character for the few pages that he's on.
But completely wasted. I mean, it's a beautifully funny moment, and you sit there and go, "I don't know what it's doing here, though."
Strange. As you said, this is the problem with the third issue. It's full of these great little moments, including, and we also find out how Luther is controlling Billy Batson,
which is very important. Which is
very important, because that leads us directly into the final splash page of issue three and the events of issue four. So there's little worms that go in his ear. Did anyone say Star Trek 2?
I was about to say the Star Trek connection. There's also one other scene I want to talk about before that last page, though, which I think is a really nice scene, which is Superman and Diana sitting out in space.
Yes.
Where they're sitting there just talking about, you know, their lives and how did she lose her, you know, her royalty. And they're playing with rocks. And they're both using basically
the bouncing them off asteroids.
Bouncing them off asteroids, which is just so obscure.
Like you'd skim stones off water, yeah.
But there's actually one shot I wanted to ask you about, how you interpreted it, because I was trying to figure out, and it's obviously important because they make a big deal out of it, and I'm trying to figure out what it meant. And twice now I've read this, and I still don't quite understand, where he actually takes her lasso, and he throws it out and pulls together a bunch of asteroids, and pulls them back together into one asteroid. Then the part that I don't get is that we have this four panels across the top, which actually show him doing something with the rope. It looks like it's falling apart or something. And it ends up with the two of them holding the rope really close together. But what's he doing with the rope?
Well, I'm not sure what he's doing with the rope, but the thing with her rope is that when it's wrapped around anyone, they can't tell a lie.
That's right. I know that part.
And to me, I think that's really – I only ever read that as symbolic of that, is that the two of them sitting there looking at each other. I mean, I think it was just him wrapping the rope back in. I think it was, again, him – I think it could have been them stretching the issue out a little bit.
Right, okay.
With a few panels. But the important panels are from basically – when you're looking at that page, it's the from the point where they're both grabbing it. So the first two panels are just them chatting. And then from that point onwards, you see increasingly closer shots of them – holding that rope. So I think it's the first time in this whole run that the two of them have sat down and had a completely honest conversation with each other, where they knew they were being honest with each other.
Yeah, that's fair.
To me, that was my reading of it.
Yeah, and that's actually a really nice scene. Because
yeah.
Wonder Woman and Superman, throughout all the years that these comics have ever been running, it's always been that eternal question, which is, why wouldn't these two get together? They're a perfect match for each other. They're both strong, they're both attractive, they're both, you know, everything about them. But they never do.
Yeah, and, you never, I mean, look, you know, workplace relationships are always awkward.
But even in, what was it, what's the other comic book I'm thinking of where, Batman, Superman, Wonder Woman, Trinity.
Yes.
All this internal dialogue in her is always like, he's a god, he's amazing. You know, it's like she can see the aura of the yellow sun's radiation coming off of him, you know, and all this sort of stuff. And yeah, but that's never in question that they would ever get together.
There's another interesting line. There's another interesting scene then when they're all sitting around discussing what to do next. And then, you know, Wonder Woman says they must surrender.
Mm.
And then Superman says, and if they refuse, she said, then it's war. And he says, but you can't have war without people dying. And she just looks at him half enraged, and then she kisses him.
Yes.
And then she takes off. And the narration says it's a final farewell, but I always thought there's something slightly else in there as well, which is kind of like she loves him for that. She loves the fact that he still, after all this time, can't imagine doing anything where people die.
Well, and yeah, because he represents everything that I think she wants to be.
Mm.
Where,
because let's forget, as you've said before, she was kicked off Themyscira for not having saved
mankind. Yeah.
Because she failed in her mission to bring peace. Yet he ostensibly has failed in that mission as well, but he's still so committed to the cause. Despite having sent himself to self-imposed guilt exile for decades, you know, she obviously still loves him, which does come up again later in the final issue.
Yeah,
they say it's a final farewell, but we know it's not.
No, basically, I think it's the parting of the ways on. I think what it's really representing is the parting of the ways on how to do this particular job now.
And it finally fires Superman up to do what he has to do.
Yeah.
Because I think he goes off straight to Bruce Wayne.
Yep.
And just yells at him for a few pages. Again, re-emphasizing the fact that the stakes are really high and that we need to help each other and yada, yada, yada. And then eventually the Captain Marvel comes and cracks open the super prison.
Yes.
Which we should have, I don't know if we haven't pointed out already, is sitting in the middle of America.
It's sitting in America, middle of Kansas, actually.
Kansas, which was destroyed from the result of the last final spectacular battle.
So Kansas is basically a wasteland now, and that's why they built it there. Now, I also think there was something else I want to point out here that I think we should just mention very quickly, even if we don't go into detail. There's also a scene in this which is actually kind of interesting. It's a Flash scene where Flash rips McKay out of the spirit world.
Yes. Yeah, no, that's interesting. And said, who the hell are you?
That's right. And brings him into the middle of the Justice League. And they're all basically saying, who are you and why are you here? And he's trying to sputter out the fact that, you know, judgment is coming and all this. And they just like, who are you? where did you come from? Because the Spectre actually says he underestimated the fact that the Flash lives in basically all dimensions at once and saw him and just basically pulled him into the current dimension.
Yeah, then Crisis rises and they turn their backs for a second and he's gone.
Mm.
And then you move into the final issue, which is the big showdown between everybody.
And the choice. What we've been building to.
It's probably one of the most beautifully illustrated issues in the history of comics.
Mm.
It's a corker, this issue. It goes on for quite a time. These are, when we say it's four issues, they are four prestige format sized issues.
Well, they're like 50, 60 pages a piece. So
yeah.
They're big issues. This a lot of this issue is taken up with the conflict.
And I actually love a lot of this issue. Having sort of slogged my way through the third issue, there's a lot to love in this final issue.
Including humankind's answer to all of this, which is Let's just nuke
them. Why don't we bomb the shit out of
them? Nuke them all. You know? Yeah. It's like, it's done. We also
you'll have to bleep out some of that, David.
I'll go through it and have a look what's there. but we also have a final confrontation, basically, between Wonder Woman and Batman, which is, yes. is fairly important, where she basically is accusing him of bringing this on. He's basically saying, you're an idiot. And they are also the ones who see the planes coming in.
Yeah.
And there's that moment where they have to work together.
And we should point out, too, that at this point, it's Wonder Woman who's drawn first blood.
Yes.
In this thing. She's put a sword straight through Baron von Bach. One of the sort of Nazi-esque characters that floated through. DC's got a whole bunch of those, these Nazi characters. They're very strange.
Well, Nazi characters are always fun.
Okay. They're always fun. I always love the way that DC does their Nazi characters. They're always these giant hulking...
Superman.
Yeah, Superman. It's very strange and funny and weird all at the same time. But yes, they have this final confrontation and the bombs are headed towards them. And Superman is desperately trying to get... Billy Batson / Captain Marvel to see sense before the bomb arrives, which
kind of comes down to the choice. This is where it comes down to, because Superman realizes at this point that Billy Batson is the person who straddles both sides. He is a god. He is a man and he is God. You know, he is a god. And so you sit there and you go, the decision has to be his. Because he's the one who can see both sides of the fence, you know? But Billy Batson, as we know, isn't in quite the right mind. So it comes down to what will he choose to do and what can they do in this situation? Now, I think the final solution is intriguing because all the way through four issues, basically, McKay has been told that he has to make this decision. When the decision finally comes down, it's not him that makes the decision. He's actually indecisive at that point. He's saying, you can't expect me to make this decision. But the decision's taken out of his hands. Because Superman basically is giving that decision to Billy Batson.
Yeah.
Which I think is a very interesting... I think it's a very interesting turn of events that we've been working four issues to get there. And then it's not even up to him.
No, and it's actually been, again, I think he is us throughout this. He is the reader, and as I keep saying, it's up to the reader kind of to accept this and go with it, and it's ultimately the reader who will choose the direction of the comics world, because we're voting with our wallets, which is sort of interesting that the comic ends in a superhero themed restaurant. Because it is all about commercial. There is a rather, the bomb does explode in this thing, and you have a rather horrifying scene of Superman kneeling in the middle of all these superhero corpses.
Yeah.
Some of which we can recognize, but there's not too many familiar bodies in there. Because as we find out on the next page that Green Lantern's managed to shelter some of them. He's managed to shelter all the people from the Justice League. Yeah.
I think it's interesting. I also think it's interesting. I think we should put a little note in here as well, because the time has passed, obviously, since they were all in their heyday. Green Lantern seems to have become incredibly powerful. Have you noticed this? Because the entire Justice League headquarters is a Green Lantern construct.
And he just sits in space waiting.
Yeah, basically waiting. And when they're wearing the oxygen masks and all sorts of stuff up in space, they're always green. So I'm assuming they're all constructs.
Probably, yeah. You
know? So he's obviously become very powerful over the years.
Well, I suppose you would. If you sit up there with nothing to do but concentrate on one thing.
all right, let's take this into conclusion.
Okay, basically, as a result of this this explosion, Superman heads to the UN and looks like he's about to destroy it.
Well, to say that he's pissed is a minor understatement.
Yeah, but then just as this happens, this is finally where Norman McKay steps in and has his moment, and says basically says, no, you look, Clark, you blame yourself for Captain Marvel, for Magog and Kansas for 10 years that ended today, but in your anger, you're once again forgetting once more what humans feel, what they fear, and they won't forgive you for this. Forgive yourself, because, you know, if you go ahead, no one else will. And he does, and in that just in that moment, all of the other surviving superheroes arrive, and Superman finally comes to the conclusion that the problems we face still exist. We're not going to solve them for you. We're going to solve them with you, and not by ruling above you, but by living among you. Which kind of brings the DCU full circle.
Which, and in fact, is a topic that was raised actually in the Justice League animated series. If you ever watched the Justice League animated series, where they actually said we have to get out of space, basically, and down amongst the people, you know? And I think that was the problem with the Justice League. They became this holier-than-thou organization, and they needed to reconnect with the people they're supposed to be protecting. And this is, they're doing exactly what all those young hotshot superheroes were doing, which is that they were being the superheroes and the other people were the normals.
Yes.
Whereas they needed to be the normals, you know, and that was the thing. They needed to be down there with them, know what it's like. And I think that's kind of what the whole moral of this story is stop thinking of yourself as greater than everybody else.
Yeah. And you know, it ends on a nice, happy note. And I love some of the scenes that it ends. Everyone's basically, you know, Diana gets her crown back, and Clark starts tilling soil again in Kansas and builds a monument, and Norman goes back to being a preacher, and he's basically saying that you know, the future's much like prophecy is open to interpretation. And then they have this wonderful little scene at the end, when they're all in this superhero cafe, where Diana and Clark turn up waiting for someone, and it's Bruce, and they've got some news for him that they said they can't wait to surprise him with it, and of course Bruce guesses immediately that Diana's pregnant, and because he is the world's greatest detective. I love some of the scenes in this. It's like, you know, they're looking around for something to eat, and all the meals are named after. It's like, this is the Power Girl chicken sandwich.
Yes.
And Bruce says, "What's the cut?" And he says, "Breast." and then Bruce goes to order. He says, "A steak, well done." Which, there's the man of beef. There's the steak, well done. You know, and there's some really fun moments. In there, they're building to, and basically when they do surprise Bruce by saying, "We want you to be the Godfather," which has one of the most wonderful lines at the end of the thing, where he says, "You realize you've just handed me influence over the most powerful child in the world." Says, "I thought you agreed rather quickly." And then he says, "The child of Superman and Wonder Woman and Batman, imagine what kind of kid she'll be. Battler for truth, justice, and a new American way. I can hardly wait to see it for myself. Let's go home and dream about the future." Which is a wonderful end thing.
Absolutely.
And it's a kind of world you'd love to spend a bit more time with, but it ends on a really nice note. I mean, look, overall, it's a really, really amazing book. As we've said, that there is some flat points. If you do want to follow up, there is a book called The Kingdom, which is set 20 years after Kingdom Come, also written by Mark Waid, and it wasn't received very well, but I've not read it yet.
I'm going to have a look for that.
Yeah, it's just called The Kingdom. The art's not by Alex Ross.
Right.
It's by Ariel Olivetti and Mike Zeck. And it doesn't use the same visual style. And the storyline is a direct continuation, according to the description here, and an extension of the original storyline, fleshing out areas of the future that were not explored in the original four-part series. They say, while Kingdom Come can easily exist as a standalone, The Kingdom is not a complete storyline in and of itself, and exists only as a continuation to Kingdom Come. So I've been meaning to get that for a while, but it is available as a trade paperback at the moment.
Right.
Also, if you're interested in other things, as I said earlier, there was the Thy Kingdom Come part of the Justice Society of America, the third volume of Justice Society. And there's also a major subplot of Justice League Generation Lost, which was written by Judd Winnick and Keith Giffen. It was a maxi series, and the Generation Lost concerns the events of Kingdom Come. And apparently, according to the Wikipedia entry, the story sees Maxwell Lord being tasked by the Entity with stopping Magog before he can inadvertently trigger an apocalyptic war between Earth superheroes, which ultimately brings Magog and Lord into conflict with the Justice League International. To drive the point home, the Entity shows Lord a series of visions taken directly from Kingdom Come, including Magog and the Justice Battalion attacking Parasite. So, which is alluded to in here. So there are certainly other things that have sort of built on this. And I'm it's sort of interesting that they, you know, they did try and bring it back into the main continuity via things like Thy Kingdom Come in particular.
That's interesting, yeah.
Because it is such, it did sit, as this description I just read out said, it does sit very nicely as its own standalone story. But it is so deeply entrenched in DC mythology that I wonder, someone who's not a DC fan, how much they would get out of this without knowing who all these people are. I mean, what do you think, Dave?
I'd be curious to actually have a look at it, because I'm not as steeped in DC as you. So I think that could be an interesting, it's almost like an interesting experiment at this point, because you sit there and you look at it and go, are they making an insular book that is just for the fans, or are they making something that they hope can expand out and make people want to find out who these people are? You know what I mean? So it's, I don't know how, and you say it wasn't very well received though, is that right?
The Kingdom, the follow-up, yeah. No, I don't think it was. So
so it makes me wonder if it failed.
Yeah, look, you know, it was a, it's interesting here, actually, so the Kingdom was also criticized by some and lauded by others for the concept of hypertime. Hypertime was an in-story metaphor for reader response and canonicity, variously described as a river in tributaries of continuity, a geometric construct, and in various other ways, deliberately mutable ways. So it seems that even with that, he was directly responding to fans' you know, version of continuity and what fans were demanding and that kind of thing as well. So I'm guessing that he was trying to continue hit the idea of his response, where he saw the comics industry going. Yeah. And it's interesting that this was written, The Kingdom was written in 1999, you know, almost at the start of the new millennium, which is when I started reading comics again.
It was also the birthplace of the current run of popular movies and when it was all becoming mainstreamed.
Absolutely. So it's, I don't know, I think when you take it in that sense, Kingdom Come and anything else that branches off it are an amazing, I just also noticed that there's a whole lot of one-shot books that came off the Kingdom as well, titled GOG, The Kingdom Kid Flash, Nightstar, Offspring, Planet Krypton, and Son of the Bat.
You know, this is vaguely feeling a little bit like Flashpoint.
Yeah, yeah, very much so. I think DC's had a very deliberate sort of strategy with their books for a long time. Yeah. But look, overall, this is kind of one of those essential reads.
I believe so.
And it is, and nothing in my reread has made me change my mind. I was surprised, actually, this time, having reread it, how flat that third issue was. And how repetitive it got after a while.
There are some key moments in there that you need, but it all does feel just a little bit like they're padding it.
If this had been a 3-issue miniseries, it may have been the most powerful book ever written. But unfortunately, it's extended a little too long, so it sort of misses out on full marks if we were giving a rating. But we're not.
It's definitely an ambitious book, and I think the creators of this book really went out on a limb with it to try and do something that was just completely out there. But I think you're right. I think they may have just bitten off a little bit too much than they can chew.
Look, at the end of the day, it reminds people, and I think this was its intention. It reminds people why we love comics and why we love heroes, and I think that's probably.
And it also has a very simple message, which is careful what you wish for.
Yep, exactly right.
You know what I mean? So, And then it's like we were talking, we take it to the film world, but we were talking about Captain America, and we were saying everybody wants their superheroes to be darker like Dark Knight. And there's a situation where you go, not all superheroes can be like the Dark Knight, because, you know, that character suits that dark, moody thing. Captain America would not have worked. You know what I mean? And it's the same with the printed books. You sit there and go, you can't make Superman a dark and brooding, moody character. It doesn't work. You know what I mean? It doesn't suit him. It doesn't fit him.
Will.
And that's why when he does take on that dark tone in this book, it doesn't feel right. It doesn't sit well, you know? And that's why it is eating him up inside. So when he does finally have that turning point at the end and realize that he can't keep going like this, he has to come down and talk to the people and become, you know, become Clark again, essentially, you know? Because that's who he is. He isn't Cal. He is Clark, you know? And it's a lovely moment where in the cemetery when Diana finally says, "See you later, Clark," you know, and she gives him back the glasses, you know, and you sit there and go, "It's a lovely moment," you know, because it's bringing him back to Earth.
Absolutely.
You know, and I think that's really, really important in this sort of thing. I don't know. It's funny because you talk about all this extended universe and I sit there and go, I don't know how much of this I would want to extend out.
Yeah, that's a good point.
You know, I look at it and go, to me, it is a finished story. I don't know if we really need to, and obviously DC felt they did, but I don't see how it would stretch well. And I could see them doing like the one-off, like those little one-shots in the world, in the universe of that's going on around that time. But to tell a story 20 years later or to continue the story into another thing, I go, I'm just not sure if I would actually be interested.
No, and it does in such a beautiful fashion. I think when I say I want to spend some more time with the characters, it's because by the end of it, you are reminded, as I said, why you like the character. So you do think. But I think in that sense, then you read this, and then you go back and read all your classic Superman stories, or you keep reading all the books that you want to read because, you know, that's what this is meant to do. It's meant to reinvigorate my love of comics, and it does that quite well.
It does that, yes.
Which is probably to bring this full circle back to that first story of this issue, which was about the New 52, which is what that is meant to be doing in some ways, but in other ways it's not doing that for me, which was, again, is one of my major complaints that I've had of the New 52 the whole time, which is that at the moment we've got versions of characters that I don't love yet.
Yeah, that's right.
And so, you know, I kind of think in some ways, you know, people need to reread something like Kingdom Come now to remind us that maybe, you know, bottom line sales figures are not necessarily what you need to worry about. I mean, if you put all your, you know, rather than having 10 Bat books to increase sales, if you put all your good creative energy into one or two Bat books, you know, maybe, just maybe, you would have a really, really solid story and great artist that you could use every week, and that they would actually bring more readers to the table because it's just damn good copy.
It's a very, very, very good point, because basically what you're saying is they're diluting the brand by spreading it out over so many books.
And I think that's exactly it. I mean, the fact is, in the DCU, they've actually literally done an in-continuity story of Batman trying to create a franchise.
Yes.
You know, Batman Incorporated. So that is literally DC saying, this is what we're doing, you know, with our universe.
And how many titles can we spin out?
I worry about that. At the moment, I actually think we've got some good books out of it.
Some, but we also got Nightwing. Batwing.
Batwing, yeah.
Which is one of the most useless books ever written.
Yeah, I mean, some of it's okay, and the art's not bad. But it is just pointless.
It's a retread of something we've already got. We don't need it. Anyway, look, this debate could go on forever because and that's the thing about Kingdom Come, is it actually does spark this kind of debate where you sit there and go, you know, we want to be invigorated by our heroes. We want to love our comic books. But there comes a time where you sit there and go, how much of this is just you trying to make a buck off of me?
Absolutely.
You're right. Some of the New 52 does feel that way. When they said we were launching brand new 52 titles, shouldn't they have aimed to have made 52 brilliant titles?
Yes.
But instead they made about 30 really good titles and about 22 substandard books that we hope might turn into something.
Mm. You know, it's like, I mean, you look at the lessons learned from that chart that we pulled up at the start of it, like how was it IDW that had almost 7% of the market share, and that's probably based on one or two really good books that they're publishing at the moment.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so, if they can do that with one or two really good books, imagine what you could do with, you know, 25 awesome books with Image, top talent in the industry.
Image is high up on that list. Image has a lot of books, but let's face it, a lot of their business comes from two books in particular. It comes from Invincible and Walking Dead. You know, and so it's like and Walking Dead has been very clear and very pure since its start. It knows exactly what it is, and it just keeps doing the same thing. They don't do spin-off comics. They don't say, "Oh, now we're going to do Walking Dead: The Other Coast." You know what I mean? It's like we just keep going with the same characters. You know,
I'm sure it's been discussed.
Oh, I'm sure it has. But to their credit, they haven't done that.
No, exactly right.
And I think that there's a certain purity to that, and I think that's what. We're kind of lacking a little bit in the costumes at the moment with the capes and costume heroes, because there's so many.
Yes.
And the thing is, they don't all deserve their own book.
Definitely not.
Some of them are just support characters, you know, and you can have a million heroes, but you've got to determine who is actually worth paying ticket price for and who is somebody who can guest star.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the moral we'll leave it on, because we're running really long today.
Yes, it's been a very long show.
It's a very long show. So we're going to leave it on that and on that wonderful wonderful thought of the day. Now we haven't picked a book for next week.
We haven't. Let's just pull one out.
Let's do that.
What randomly. Can I just put it down and we'll just do volume 2 of the Daredevil Frank Miller run?
Volume 2 of the Daredevil Frank Miller run.
There's a run that they put out called Daredevil Visionaries, and it was Frank Miller. It was basically it's the issues that make up the Elektra saga. So
okay, cool.
That's what we're doing. We're doing Daredevil the Elektra saga.
Daredevil the Elektra saga. Okay, I will source that out.
I will tell you which issues to find there.
Yes, please, and I'll put it up onto the post. Okay, yep. So that people know which issues to look for. All right. Thank you very much. How do people find more about you, Richard?
You can find me online, strangely enough. You can find me on therealbits.com. That's the REELbits.com. It's a film review website. But I also post heaps of stuff in there on comic book movie news, and that's where you can find I'll republish the podcast up there as well, and you can find me on Twitter constantly at DVDBits.
Fantastic. And you can find everything to do with me by going to geekactually.com, and there's a follow us link on the front page, which actually has my Twitter account, my Facebook, and all that sort of stuff. So you can just go over there and find out everything about me just by going to geekactually.com. And that's it. I think we're going to put a bow on this one and get this sucker up online. What do you think?
I think it was a bumper first issue back. For
I
the
think
year.
It was. I don't have any apologies for being long. We've been away for a week.
There you go.
And
two for the price of one.
Damn straight. All right, Richard, I will see you again next week.
See you then, David.
See ya. Bye, everybody.